I would say that my advice for anyone who works for someone else is you can be an intrapreneur. You can think like one. You can act like one. You have this safety net that we don't have of working for a larger company. And I think the people that succeed and get raises and get promoted and are thought leaders within companies are the ones that take risks, the ones that can lead not only with conviction, but with vulnerability, and who are great at taking others along with them. I think too often you hear these people at the top, I, and I truly believe you might hear my voice today, but I'm only here because of the team that I have. And so how do you take the risk, bring the people with you, keep promoting others, and do things that might sound crazy within a corporate structure, but that actually allow you to shine?
You just heard from Rebecca Minkoff, fashion designer, podcast host, entrepreneur, and author of Fearless, which was released this past summer. Hello there. I'm Celeste Headley. Welcome to Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. This podcast has just the best advice you could possibly get from some of the most brilliant minds around. They have got tips that will help you navigate both your career and your personal life. So before we get started, I want to take just a moment and let you know that you're not too late to register for the first ever Pennsylvania Conference for Women Virtual Career Fair happening on November 9th. It's free, it's 100% virtual, and you'll see companies there that want to hire women just like you. So if you or someone you know has had to make a difficult career move over these past months, we hope you'll take advantage of this opportunity. You can sign up today at paconferenceforwomen.org/careerfair. Registration is also now open for the virtual Massachusetts Conference for Women, which will be held on December 2nd, featuring Regina King, Selma Blair, Stacey Abrams, Allison Felix, Chloe Zhao, so many more. Please visit maconferenceforwomen.org to register. Now, in this episode of Women Amplified, I get the chance to talk with fashion mogul and social activist Rebecca Minkoff about her professional journey, her successes, some of her failures, the challenges that she faced along the way, and what she learned from them. Whether you're starting a business or leading a corporate team, this episode will arm you with experience-based advice that might allow you to take the driver's seat in your own career and your own life, and just possibly unleash the fearless entrepreneur within. So let's dig in. I want to start with a question that I kind of have been asking a lot lately, but I haven't been throwing it away like I used to, which is, how are you doing? I mean, I feel like most of us don't really answer that question most of the time, but at this moment, coming out of a traumatic period, maybe the answer is different for a lot of us.
Overall, I don't have any complaints. I have healthy children, a great family. We moved to Florida during the second half of the pandemic temporarily to have our kids go to school because they never shut down and I would commute. And so we were able to have as unrestricted, I guess, life as we could.
What do you do when you are a manager, a boss, and you reach a point where you feel overwhelmed? How do you handle that? Maybe you can't step away, but you physiologically and emotionally need to.
Usually when I'm overwhelmed, it's because there are many things happening all at once. And I think a good example, it was like we were launching a new product category at Rebecca Minkoff. My book was coming out. We have to think about Fashion Week. Then there's a collaboration that's happening in fourth quarter. And so like when all vectors are occurring and then the kids are like, oh, I got to do their summer camp schedule as well and grocery shop and whatever, add to the list. That's when I become overwhelmed. And for me, it's always been very helpful. I have these beautiful post-it notes that are my saviors with lines on them. And I literally just segment out what do I need to do and write it all down. And like, of this, what is a priority? And it just helps get everything sort of out of my head, swirling around like a tornado and onto a piece of paper where I can actually begin to tackle it in a very methodical way. So that's always been something that's been helpful and tactical. I also sometimes will be like, all right, stop. What is most important that I need to focus on right now? And what can I let go of? Because we can't juggle it all. And so sometimes I'm just like, well, that ball's got to drop and I have to be okay with that. And so I think it's also knowing when to just let something go, even if you're going to pick it up back later. That's really been helpful to me too.
Let's talk about your book, because, you know, it's interesting to me. The book is called Fearless, and you just expressed an anxiety that you have, a little bit of fear that you have. Explain to me what you mean by fearless, and is it supposed to be literally without fear?
It is definitely not supposed to be without fear. I called it fearless because you are going to experience that emotion that's been hardwired into us for longer than, you know, 10,000 years, let's just say. And it's there to protect you from life-threatening situations. But that emotion also enters into our personal and professional lives and holds us back. So my goal is that you're going to recognize that fear. You're going to use my rules to sort of have stable guideposts with how to take a risk and how to think about risk from a business perspective. And then you go, you know what? I'm scared, but here I go. Let's do it.
Can you walk me through one of the rules, especially if it's one that became sort of crucial for you over the pandemic?
I think that the crucial rule that became my mantra during the pandemic is, well, there's two really. One of them is that sometimes chapter 21 is called It's Endless, and success is being able to keep going. And if I look at my past and history, there was invitations not only to fail, but to give up so many more times than I like to admit. And instead of just being like, all right, I'm thrown in the towel, this is too hard, my co-founder and I just got back up. So I think that that's something that throughout last year was a mantra of mine of, we just got to keep going. We might come out of this a different company. We are a lot smaller, but we kept going. Every day there was a reason why we should walk away. I think the other is to take risk. Sometimes you win and sometimes you learn. And I think when you have failed, rather than going into a shame hole or berate yourself or tell yourself you're a piece of crap, it's like, what did I learn here? And I think anytime you can learn something, you'll be stronger and better for it. So when you reframe failure like that, I think it definitely can help you to bounce back sooner.
Is that tied into the advice that you also give on unlocking creativity? I mean, it seems to me like sometimes finding the upside or the learning opportunity in failure requires a creative mind, does it not?
It definitely requires a creative mind, but that doesn't, you know, some people will immediately look to creative minds and say, oh, I'm not an artist. But anyone in business or in corporate America, you have creativity because you're solving problems, and that takes a lot of creativity. And you're painting, hopefully, your purpose and path, and that in itself is creative.
So can we talk a little bit about the idea of how to unlock that? Not just accept that you can be creative regardless of your job, right? But also how you tap into the creative part of yourself.
So I think that if you look up the definition of creativity, it's someone that is making something. And we're all making something, whether that is our life or a child or a meal or an experience or a job or a company. So right there, it gives you a much broader canvas of what you're creating. And then I think it's really important to hone in on what makes you happy, what gives you purpose. And not everything that gives you purpose is going to make you rich or make you money. But how do you sort of align your life to be more purposeful towards what does those things for you? And I think when you can start looking at that, and if you do want your purpose to make you money, maybe it's not an immediate overnight gratification, but how do you start to pivot your life to embrace that? Or how do you, you know, if you know you're going to work at a job you hate forever, how do you make sure that you have a very rich life on the outside that fulfills your passions? And the creativity and what you, the spin on it is up to each person. But I think discovering those things as sort of the basics for that are the first steps to take.
Interesting. Each time I ask you about one of the three topics, your book title says Unlocking Creativity, Courage, and Success. Every time I mention one of them, it leads us to the next. And that's true here because we're talking about creativity, but you're also talking about how to define success, right? I mean, you're saying that the definition of success is individual or unique to each person.
100%. I think we're all brainwashed to some degree of what we think success looks like. If you just take Mad Men, right? They did a good job advertising to us. You're only a success if you're rich and famous. And I think it's up to us to reframe, what does success look like for ourselves, each individual person? And do the things that I'm doing feed me or not? I ask myself that question every day. Am I just doing this because it's what I have to do? What about it makes me excited? Okay, how can I focus more on that? For me these days, the big risky things is what makes me excited. So that's what I like to pour my energy into. And I think that can become what success feels like.
Is there a different strategy for taking a big risk than there is for going about your day-to-day job, getting through your daily works? Do you do something different when what you're doing is risky, is a gamble?
I like to weigh the risk as I go extreme when I weigh risk. Like, will I lose my livelihood? Will I damage my brand? Will I upset someone? If I can say no to those things, and I'm sure there's a couple more things on the box list I should check off, then I'm like, okay, what do I have to lose? You know, we've also become known as a brand that is willing to take risks and sometimes have failures. And so I think that we get a little bit of a free pass sometimes because we're just like, you know what? If we mess up, we messed up. If that idea didn't work, okay, it didn't work. And so I think the more people can embrace that, the more understanding people will be of like, well, at least they're trying something. At least they're like innovating and not just staying still for concern of what people think about them.
I feel like this is something a lot of people are thinking about right now or have been thinking about over the past year. There's been a lot of job insecurity over the pandemic for business people like yourself or myself. It's been volatile and very much like a roller coaster. And then for people who are working jobs for other companies, many of them have either had hours cut, they've been laid off. There's just been a lot of change. And I wonder, how do you weigh your options when you're deciding whether to become an entrepreneur, whether to start your own business or commodify something that you already do, perhaps, against the safety of a job and a salary?
I think that question is answered differently depending on how old you are and also what your responsibilities are. I would tell a 20-something with no kids, just their college tuition debt, full force, go for it, because they have nothing to lose. I would tell a woman who's feeding her family and is more entrenched in a certain career path, do this more safely because you do have to provide for your family and you do have a role to fulfill to be able to take care of them. So I think it's hard to answer it specifically, but I think when you've sort of said, it's like gambling, what can you afford to lose? When I bought my first Bitcoin many years ago, the friend talking me into it was like, can you afford to lose $5,000? And I was like, it would really suck. I don't want to lose $5,000, but sure. Okay. You know what? Let's do it. And so can you approach the risk that you're taking of, can you afford to lose whatever it is if you don't make it? And if that's the case, and again, you will have learned something if it fails, then I say go for it, because there's so much regret or what happened or what could happen, and you'll never know until you try.
Well, how important is the right degree in that decision? I mean, you have talked about your pathway as being a little unorthodox. You didn't follow what we think of as a traditional path. You didn't go to university. For people who maybe, you know, sometimes we go down these checklists to make it a less of a gamble, right? Is an advanced degree helpful in that regard?
I'm not going to ever be the person to dissuade someone from going to school and getting an advanced degree. I think we're coming into an age where people are questioning if that degree is going to get them where they want to go in life, or are they going to be saddled with so much debt that they can never take any risk? So I didn't go to school. My co-founder didn't go to school. And here we are. And could we have made smarter decisions had we been at Wharton MBA or gotten our MBA at Wharton? Maybe. But what I really think is I probably would have met people there that would have accelerated what I was going to do anyways. I don't know that I would have learned it sitting in a classroom. I think enough can be said about the learning takes place on the job. It takes place in the business. It's not sitting on your butt.
There is this sort of trend recently for articles in Business Insider or Forbes to say, here's the habits that successful CEOs have, basically implying that if you do this thing, if you wake up at 5:30 every morning and do calisthenics for 15 minutes and make your bed every time and drink 20 ounces of water, then you'll be successful too. I wonder what you make of that whole sort of trend. of listing out what successful people do and encouraging other people to follow those habits?
I guess I'm sort of impartial. I think if any of those habits sound fun to you, try them. But you can't recreate molecule by molecule or habit by habit whatever success someone else has. I started following this fitness instructor because everybody else did it and because he was the top guy. And guess what? I found a great change in my strength because of it. And I was like, cool, that's a habit I'm going to keep. But not because I'm following the pack now. It's actually because what he does works. So I say, try it. If it works for you, awesome. If it doesn't, throw it away and develop your own habits.
I mean, is this the same kind of attitude you bring to business? How long do you wait before deciding that something isn't working?
In business, we react a lot quicker in terms of the data is there, it's there every day. So we know very quickly if something's not working. But then you have other parts of the business, if you're doing top of funnel activations or you're doing a campaign that can't be measured, you have to know that it's going to take time. It's a slow build. I think a good example is about 4 years ago, we had a woman in the company that decided that we should no longer do any PR activities, essentially. That PR wasn't important, that being culturally relevant was. And she shut off that funnel. And within 3 months, we saw a huge decline in brand search and mentions. And we switched and pivoted, but it took us 6 months to get back there. So I think that you can't expect these things that you start to change overnight.
You're listening to Rebecca Minkoff, award-winning fashion designer and author of Fearless, released just this past summer. If you love this podcast, share it with other people. We offer 3 episodes every month, and that includes our new segment, That's a Good Question. In that segment, I get the chance to problem solve with one of our listeners to help her work through a professional or personal challenge. So if you're grappling with a problem, we would love to help. To participate, just fill out a submission form online at conferencesforwomen.org/podcast. And if you're selected, our producer will reach out directly and take it from there. Now let's get back to our conversation. Okay, you have now been an entrepreneur for 2 decades, almost 2 decades?
Yes, almost 2 decades.
What would you think, looking back at the woman who started out 20 years ago almost, what's the guidance that might have helped you the most?
The woman that sold my bags early on was very tough, sometimes to the point of just cruel, but she taught me the value of customer being first, of listening, of just being really damn good at what you do and striving to always become better. And I think that as much as I had fantasies of when we just get to X, I'll be able to put my feet up and not be on the gas pedal, I quickly realized when we hit what I thought was the number that I was like, oh, you actually just have to drive faster now. There's no putting your feet up. And so I think knowing that demand of excellence is something that has to continue, there's no sleeping.
How long do you plan to continue? Do you have a date scheduled for, all right, this is the point when I actually do take my foot off the gas?
I have fantasies of when I'm going to take my foot off the gas, but I'm just not there yet. I mean, I think if we're talking about business and you're just doing the math, if I own X percent of my company, I need to hit Y before I can sell it and come away with something meaningful and have, you know, what happens normally when one sells a company, where I could have my job and still be part of it, but the pressure isn't only on me and my co-founder and our team. It's on a whole new group that hopefully helps it grow. So I think that there's a number in my head. I don't ever want to do anything else. So it's not like I would just quit either. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally understand what you mean. I mean, I find myself constantly coming up with numbers and then discarding them. It changes all the time for me of when I think I'm going to start releasing the pressure. And I'm sure this is a different calculation for people who are not business owners or entrepreneurs. And I wonder, what kind of advice do you have for our listeners who, I mean, the majority of our listeners are in traditional roles. They're either salaried or they have a boss of some kind and a wage, and they're working within often a corporate environment. What advice might you have for them in terms of being successful in that role?
I would say that my advice for anyone who works for someone else is you can be an intrapreneur. You can think like one, you can act like one. You have this safety net that we don't have of working for a larger company. And I think the people that succeed and get raises and get promoted and are thought leaders within companies are the ones that take risks, the ones that can lead not only with conviction, but with vulnerability, and who are great at taking others along with them. I think too often you hear these people at the top, I, and I truly believe you might hear my voice today, but I'm only here because of the team that I have. And so how do you take the risk, bring the people with you, keep promoting others, and do things that might sound crazy within a corporate structure, but that actually allow you to shine?
I mean, this is sort of a question I think a lot of people have. Again, the pandemic has changed a lot of things. And we are hearing a lot of stories about people who are creating new limits to what they will tolerate in their workplace. For example, many people are now saying, if my boss forces me to go back into the office full time rather than having at least a hybrid remote situation, I'll quit. What kind of advice do you have for someone for making those kind of decisions as successful as they can be, for making sure that they're deciding, I guess, their walk away points in as productive a way as possible?
I mean, I'm sure that each situation is so unique, but if you love what you do and it's more about the work-life balance that you want to have, everyone has to stick their neck out to some degree. So could your first opportunity be, instead of I quit if you force me to, it's, hey, here's a petition signed by X amount of people in the company, and this is how we want it to change, and this is how you can measure our success. I'm only giving women examples, but if you look at the right to vote or the right to our bodies or what Susan Fowler did at Uber, all these women took extreme risk. They took societal cancellation. They went to jail. Not Susan Fowler, you know, or yeah. Rosa Parks on the bus. Like, you think she was comfortable sitting on that bus, not moving? Hell no. So like, if you're scared of your boss being upset with you because you want to work from home because you're more productive and happier, like, I'm sorry, but you got to stick your neck out if you want to keep working there and you love it except for that. So like, how do you galvanize and make change within your company and be the person that ushered that in versus the person that's like, I'm effective this decision and I'm out. If you do want to leave, there's so many great opportunities now for people. I think technology makes it so easy to start a website, become a brand. So many of the things that were hard before are easier, but that also means that you have to be better at cutting through the noise. So where are you going to turn to and how are you going to do that is a whole other probably podcast. But I'd say before you jump, make sure your eggs are in order.
So that's one class of women. And then we have another class of women that had to leave their job because they didn't have a choice. I mean, almost 2 million women left the workforce since February of last year, 2020. And so there's a lot of women right now having to weigh how much they can work, how much they want to work, and then how to get back in when we know that the job market is not always very forgiving to people who have gaps in their resume. Any guidance for somebody who's in that situation?
Yeah, I would say that I can only speak to the last recession, but out of that recession was a boom of incredible companies, whether it was Airbnb or Uber, companies that have fundamentally changed how we operate. And I think that rather than look at the horrific statistics of 2 million women leaving, could we say, here's 2 million potential entrepreneurs? Or here's 2 million potential founders of companies that some will change the way we fundamentally live. And so my say to them is there's companies like The Second Shift, which offer part-time work for women, where you basically get to filter out for your perfect job. There's communities like mine, the Female Founder Collective, and our entire goal is to educate women on how they can start and succeed in launching their companies and make sure that the gaps that they have are filled with other women founders educating them. And so if you are going to go that road, like, prepare for battle, because it's not going to be an easy road, but you can do it. You just got to make sure that, again, you are ready and stocked with your ammo to set out there. And we're already starting to see the numbers. I think I read in the news, it was like 2,000 businesses a day are being started by women. So we know it's not working. And so now it's up to us to figure out, okay, well, what does working look like for us?
What do you think it might look like? I mean, as we come out of this, what do you think we might see in the year or two into the future? What do you think will change?
What I see within our collective already is it's solo entrepreneurs or companies of two. They have a great product that they can market not too expensively. It pays for their living. Are they going to be the next unicorn? Never. But I don't think anyone should expect that they should be a unicorn. I think, again, marketing and magazines have done a really good job of putting a lot of women on the cover, and we all think we need to have billion-dollar brands that IPO, when many or 99% of us won't ever have that or should ever have that because it's not what we're doing. And so I think there's opportunity, again, because technology has made it so easy that if you have an idea, the path to launch is not hard. It's getting an audience and sticking around that probably is more challenging. So I think, again, do you want to work to live or do you want to live to work? And based on that, you can probably get the answer of, at my company, pre-pandemic, I was like, man, I could see that my life would be balanced if I could get to the office at 10. It would allow me to drop off the kids and go work out without feeling guilty or waking up at 6 a.m. And we enter office hours at like 4 or 5. So I could get home and make dinner, which I do enjoy, and give a bath to my kids and not feel so rushed instead of getting home at 7. And at the time, it just felt like, well, how are we going to do that if no one else is going to do that? And then we'll be the company that falls behind because everyone's working. And now, like, we're never going back to full time. I think we're going to mandate 2 days a week. My head of e-com just worked remote from Europe for the last week, and we didn't care. So I think that for my company, I think, ironically, in a time that's been so horrific, found what balance could look like as we emerge, because it set a stage where everyone's rethinking it. And so we're going, what's right for us and the people that work here?
I mean, that sounds like an encouragement to everybody to stay flexible, to not draw lines in the sand. Is that what you're saying?
I think you shouldn't draw lines in the sand. And I think that people are listening. I think it went from like, everyone's losing their job to everyone's quitting very quickly.
Yes, that's true.
And I'm like, are we being manipulated here? But I think that employers are listening and watching, because I think they're all scared they're going to lose their staff after reading about this rash of resignations.
Do you give thought to retention and how you might keep staff members?
I definitely do. Our particular issue has always been that another company comes in and offers a huge wad of cash to someone that we can't compete with. And so I think we're trying to figure out, like, what can we offer to someone if it's not a $25,000 raise? What are some perks that they get to have? And we ironically just had a situation with one woman who was offered, I think, even more than that to leave. And we said, listen, we know we can't compete on salary, but if you stay with us for 1 to 2 more years, you'll be able to command probably double, triple that because of the perception we have as a brand with our innovation and our risk-taking and longevity, whereas this brand can pay you a lot of money, but no one cares about them. So you'll probably get there and kind of be potentially make incremental raises, but maybe not the jump you eventually want to have. And she could see, if she looked out 2 more years, that we were right and she decided to stay. So I think each individual person is so different. And retention is definitely top of mind. And I think now more than ever, we're trying to make sure that people feel happy and valued, even though it's an environment where it's not like, oh, we can just give out tons of raises and bonuses after the last year we had. So we're trying to make them feel better in other ways until we're a little bit more back on our feet.
I know you shortened your work hours, but are you also working remotely more now?
Yeah. So we've only asked that people come in 1 to 2 days a week, and to sign in when they do. But again, I don't think anyone's planning to do more than 3 days a week in the office ever again.
Ever? Like forever? This is just your work style now, 3 days at the most in the office?
I don't want to say forever. And I can only say for now. But there's definitely times where it is every day. If it's a fashion week or my design team, they love coming to the office. They've been there every day since May of last year. They didn't want to stay home and they couldn't design over Zoom. So they made the back of my office, it looks like someone's apartment, and they love it, and they play music and they got their plants growing. And so I'm not telling them, oh, you can only be here 3 days a week. They want to be there 5 days a week and no one's forcing them to. So I think we're leaving it flexible. But to my head of accounting, who lives in New Jersey and has a 2-hour commute each day, she never needs to come in, and that's fine.
So before we wrap up here, I wanted to bring this back around to your book, Fearless, because I love the way that you set it out as sort of rules, which are guidelines. And I wonder, in light of all we've been talking about over what's changed in the past year and what may or may not never go back to the way it was, can you give us a rule that might help us with this kind of, I don't want to say uncertainty, but like it's a new landscape and that can be unsettling to people.
I think it's a new landscape. I'm really proud of this example that I gave to my son, but he's 9 and sometimes I feel like he can be a little bit short-sighted. And I said to him, I was like, you know, your great-grandfather who spoke Russian was sent here on a boat without his family to Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and had to somehow find, I don't even know how people met up those days. Like the boat arrives, and you're just supposed to like be like, I think you're my uncle. I don't know. I just like to look at history because I'm like, what we're complaining about is nothing. If you look at the last pandemic, what, 20 million people died, or the Great Depression where bread lines wrapped around the street. So for me, I think always going to problems of comparable magnitude or history makes me go, all right, I can do this. What am I complaining about? Not being on a bestseller list yet? Okay, fine. Get over it. So I think change is scary. There's been an over-proliferation of fear-mongering, especially around this year. And so it is very scary. And you can't negate that emotion, but you can't let it stop you. You have to find a way that you're going to go forward anyways and not let it be that that part of your brain controlled you. Because that would be a terrible thing to say. I'm the effect of a secretion in my brain.
Rebecca Minkoff, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We so hope you enjoyed this episode with fashion mogul, entrepreneur, podcast host, and author, Rebecca Minkoff. You can check out her luxury brand at RebeccaMinkoff.com and be sure to check out her book, Fearless. It's at the Conference Bookstore, which offers free shipping. Registration is still open, by the way, for the virtual Massachusetts Conference for Women on December 2nd. You will hear from an incredible lineup of women. Chloe Zhao, Stacey Abrams, Regina King, Selma Blair, so many others. You can see the full speaker lineup and also register while you're there at conferencesforwomen.org. The Conferences for Women is the largest network of women's conferences in the nation. They draw more than 55,000 women and men to annual events in Boston, Philadelphia, Austin, and California. I'm Celeste Headley. This is Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. Thank you so much for listening. Be kind and be well.